People of the Book on 101.9 High FM.
This is People of the Book on 101.9 High FM, and we've got, once again, a packed show. I've got two giveaways. I've got a few books that I'm going to be, three giveaways, a few books I'm going to be talking about, and then we're going to be interviewing Nechama Brody about her latest book. It's a crime thriller set here in Johannesburg. It's called Knuckle Bone. And so it's a full show. I'm going to start off with the serious book. There are a number of books, novels, set in the Holocaust that people are reading at the moment. One is called The Tattooist of Auschwitz. I do have a copy. I haven't got to it yet. But I do know from the WhatsApp groups that I'm on that a lot of people have read that and they have found it a very, very, very worthwhile read. The book I've got is another book we're going to discuss today. We'll get to The Tattooist of Auschwitz in a few weeks' time. The book that I'm looking at is called The Good Doctor of Warsaw. And this is it's a novel, but it's a fictionalization of a true story, a true person. Beginning in Warsaw as the Second World War looms, the novel tells the story of Dr. Janusz Korczak, a real-life figure who ran an orphanage in what became the Jewish ghetto in Warsaw, which was the largest in Nazi-occupied Europe, and only 1% of its inhabitants, the inhabitants of the Warsaw ghetto, survived the war. The story of Korczak's struggle is seen through the eyes of Misha and Sofia, two young lovers determined to help Korczak and to survive the increasingly appalling conditions behind the walls of the Warsaw ghetto. As the Nazis begin their gradual, deliberate stranglehold on the desperate Jewish population, Korczak vows to keep the children in his orphanage safe. When the deportations to the Treblinka extermination camp begin, and stories about what happens there start to filter back, no one can believe that their worst fears will come true. Misha and Sofia, torn apart by events, struggle to stay alive, surviving on the hope that they'll find their way back to each other one day. This is the basic premise of The Good Doctor of Warsaw. It's written by Elizabeth Gifford. It's published by Corvus. And for this review, what I want to do is I want to read a little bit from the author's note, because that will give you a sense of what the book is really about. So this is the author's note at the end of The Good Doctor of Warsaw. This is what the author, Elizabeth Gifford, writes. As a young mum and teacher, I had a lot of questions about the best way to care for children and a lot of anxiety. I came across Janusz Korczak's words at a teaching seminar, and they burst across the landscape like a ray of sunshine. He advocated not a prescribed best way to raise children, but a relationship based on knowing who the child really was, respecting them as an individual, and working out what they need from that understanding. In other words, how to love a child. The teacher in charge of the seminar also told us about Korczak's life. I was surprised that I'd never heard about such a remarkable man, and I decided to attempt to write a book to bring his ideas and story to more people. I had two problems, however. I knew very little about his life, and I didn't know how to write a book. I attended writing classes, published three other books, and 10 years later began to write about Korczak. It was also a journey into some of the darkest history of the 20th century. I read intensively about the Warsaw Ghetto diaries and accounts of Janusz Korczak, Mary Berg, and others, and various first-hand accounts from the Oneg Shabbat archives published in the book Words to Outlive Us. I visited the British Library, the Weiner Library, and the Polish Library in London, and the Bodleian in Oxford, searching for any books I could find on Korczak. I read biographies of Korczak by Betty Jean Lifton, Hannah Olzak, Igan Newerly, and Joseph Arnon. I also managed to source some of Korczak's works, including How to Love a Child, The Child's Right to Respect, When I Am Little Again, and Little King Matt. I'm reading from the author's notes of a book, The Good Doctor of Warsaw. The book is a novelization of Dr. Janusz Korczak, who headed the orphanage in the Warsaw ghetto. And this is the author's note. Elizabeth Gifford is writing why she wrote this book. I contacted some of the various Korczak associations worldwide for information and found Misha Wroblewski, listed as head of the Cossack Association in Sweden. His son, Roman Wroblewski, replied to say that Misha had recently passed away, but that he could help with any information. I travelled to Sweden to meet Roman, and over the following years, he became a friend and trusted advisor on the story, providing a stream of information on Cossack and on the Warsaw Ghetto years. This book would not have been possible without his hard work and his kindness in sharing his parents' story. Roman's parents, Misha and Sofia, worked with Cossack both before and during the war, living in the ghetto with him and the children. They are among the less than 1% who survived the Warsaw Ghetto out of a population of over a million. The book became their story also. And just stopping to read from the author's notes, but these two people, Misha and Sofia, who are real people, became the parallel narrative in the book. The Good Doctor of Warsaw has two storylines. One is Dr. Cossack himself, and the other is Misha and Sofia. So real people's lives have been all the main characters in the book are real people, and their lives have been novelized here by Elizabeth Gifford. Back to the author's note. During my initial research, I also traveled to Warsaw to visit the Warsaw Cossack Museum in Poland, which is housed in a room of Cossack's original orphanage on Kruchmalna Street, where I was given a tour and talk by Agnieszka Witkowska-Krick. I also visited the new Polin Museum of Jewish Life in Poland. Warsaw was all but razed to the ground in the war. The medieval center is an almost perfect reconstruction that is in fact no more than 50 years old. The ghetto and many of the Jewish areas are now gone, covered by Soviet-era housing estates and modern office buildings. It is possible, however, to find parts of the wall and original buildings and to reconstruct the area mentally by walking through the historical locations on a map. My next big question after completing the first stages of research was, how do you write a book about the Holocaust? I began by producing a manuscript so plainly factual that it was difficult to read, and so, following the advice of my agents Jenny Hewson and editors at Corvus, the publisher Sarah O'Keefe and Susanna Hamilton, I rewrote the book as a newly imagined novel, fully evoking the scenes and giving myself the same allowances as a filmmaker recreating a historical story. I was very grateful for all their advice and their willingness to stay with the project and put so much work into this book. We'll be back with more from the author's notes of The Good Doctor of Warsaw by Elizabeth Gifford, and it is a novelization of one of the great but very little known World War II heroes, Dr. Janusz Korczak, after this ad break.
People of the Book on 101.9 High FM.
This is People of the Book on 101.9 High FM, and the book that we're talking about is The Good Doctor of Warsaw. It's by Elizabeth Gifford, published by Corvus Publishers, and it's a novelization of one of the, and the true story, it's the novelization of the true story of one of World War II's little-known heroes, Dr. Janusz Korczak. Janusz Korczak was a pen name acquired when he became a famous writer in Poland. Born Henry Goldschmidt in 1879, he was the son of a wealthy Jewish lawyer and his wife, who mixed freely with both Polish and Jewish friends in Warsaw. Korczak did not realize he was Jewish until his canary died when he was five, and burying it in the courtyard, was told by a Polish boy that he couldn't put a cross on the grave because it was a Jewish bird. Poland in those days was divided between three superpowers, Germany, Russia, and the Habsburg Empire. Korczak's first taste of school was at a Russian establishment where the beating reduced him to a nervous terror, and his memory of this led to his lifelong quest to give the child a voice and foster a better understanding between children and their carers. Korczak's beloved and brilliant father died in the Tvorky lunatic asylum when Korczak was just 17, and Korczak's impoverished mother and sister relied on his income as a tutor, while hoping he would soon graduate as a doctor. Korczak later became a sought-after pediatrician, also famous for his novels charting the lives of the street children he worked with in his spare time, when not dodging the Tsar's police for his involvement in the seditious Flying University, whose groundbreaking lectures on observational psychology had Korczak enthralled. Eventually, he decided to follow his heart and leave medicine to work full-time with children at a neglected orphanage which was being run by a remarkable young woman called Stefa Wilczynska. He and Stefa formed a lifelong partnership dedicated to children. After World War I, Korczak also opened a home for Polish orphans in Warsaw, with Marina Falska as a house mother. Poland gained independence after World War I. The following decade was a golden time for Korczak's expansion of the kingdom of the child. He wrote and lectured expansively on and for children, made child-centered broadcasts, founded a children's newspaper, and served as a court advocate for teenage delinquents. But with the advent of the economic depression in the 1930s, a fascist spirit spread through Europe, and as a Jew in an increasingly nationalistic Poland, Korczak's work was curtailed. Korczak was an early pioneer of child welfare and psychology. As a young man at the beginning of the 20th century, Korczak had looked around and begun to ask why so many children were unhappy. There were vast numbers of slum children in Warsaw, neglected and unloved. Even the children of the rich seemed frustrated and resentful, in spite of their material plenty. It was as if adults had forgotten what it was like to be a child. Adults had to learn to communicate with children and speak their language again. It was a lesson he understood from experience. As a young doctor in training, he wanted to heal not only children's physical ailments, but also their souls and lives. Determined to make children's lives happier, on his first summer camp for slum children, he set out armed with the full knowledge of books on children, a bag of full of games, good intentions, and a carnation in his buttonhole. The week was chaotic. Korczak found himself at odds with the boys, shouting at them to go to sleep and even resorting to threats. Ashamed and confused, he decided to ask the boys what they thought was going wrong. It soon became clear that his one-size-fits-all policy on childcare was missing the mark with such a wide variety of children who all had different needs for sleep, food, clothes, sizes, and interests. He realized that only by listening, really listening to and knowing the children, could he begin to devise creative ways to lead them towards who they were meant to be as people. Each child was a person to be respected in terms of their thoughts and feelings. That, and a hefty dose of pre-planning for a group of 30 boys. The next summer, with lists, schedules, and a lot of effort made in getting to know each boy, he and the children had a wonderful summer in the country. He realized that child-rearing was about knowledge from failed attempts, an ongoing quest to find out what works for an individual. I want everyone to know and love the state of I do not know when it comes from raising children, so full of life and dazzling surprises. For this reason, Korczak always put respecting and getting to know a child far higher than relying on books by child experts, although they were useful. No book, no teacher can replace your own careful observation of a child. Mothers and fathers should trust the instinct about their own child based on years of watching and getting to know who their child is. This is the author's note from the book The Good Doctor of Warsaw. The author is Elizabeth Gifford, and the book is a novelization of the life of Dr. Janusz Korczak, the good doctor of Warsaw, who headed the orphanage in the Warsaw ghetto. For this reason, Korczak always put and above all, he saw child rearing as a relationship, not an exercise in control. The adult was charged with the responsibility of the child's safety and happiness, but this meant accountability, not a free pass to lose one's temper or be unfair for one's own convenience. He loathed physical punishment, viewing it as wrong and completely ineffective. He understood that an adult has to be a grown-up. Before you start laying down the law to children and bossing them about, make sure that you have brought up and educated the child inside yourself. And he saw no merit in treating childhood as if it were a mere preparation for the more important time of adulthood. Children are people today, not people tomorrow. They have the right to their cup of happiness. He taught children and adults to treat each other with empathy. He was quite happy to point out to a child that he was busy working or reading or simply tired, and that the child could perhaps amuse themselves for a while always remaining close at hand and in sight for help and comfort if needed. He taught social responsibility through the courts of peers, where children brought their grievances against each other and debated the rights and wrongs of each case, considering the feelings of others, and so developing a sense of justice and fairness. Punishments were mostly written warnings. Korczak knew that children take comfort from the religion they were raised in, and gave both Jewish and Christian children the chance to pray or go to services if they so wished. He wasn't a practicing Jew, but he had been brought up in the tenets of the religion, and though he did not follow a specific creed, he believed in a loving God and read widely from wisdom literature. His religion, he said, was the sacred duty to protect children. He believed that a child belongs to itself and that it is the duty of not only parents but the entire community to care for the children in their midst. He had no children of his own, yet he was the father to hundreds of children. Korczak firmly believed that children held the world together and that the basis of nationhood was not an ethnic or cultural group, but the decision of a people, irrespective of creed or race, to come together to care for their children. He understood that where nations decide not to care for the child, then civilization is on the verge of flying apart, which is precisely what happened when the Nazi Reich decided to murder thousands of children in 1942 in Warsaw, in Poland, and across Europe. There can be no greater contrast than this terrible decision compared to Korczak's will to protect the rights and happiness of his children, even to the very end, when he accompanied them to the death camp. Korczak's message is as pertinent today as it ever was, both in how we define a nation and in how we raise children, who are independent, happy, loved, and loving. Perhaps the best observation about Korczak comes from a child in care who was given some of Korczak's sayings to read. I wish all parents could read Janusz Korczak, because then children would be happier. This is the end of the author's note. The author is Elizabeth Gifford. The book is The Good Doctor of Warsaw, which is a novelization of Dr. Janusz Korczak, who headed the orphanage in the Warsaw ghetto. And at the end of her note, Elizabeth Gifford writes, "This book is dedicated with thanks to my own children and my husband, who lived with Korczak's story for so many years, and to Roman and all the family and children of Misha and Sophia, with great thanks for sharing their story for the next generation. And above all, this book is for Korczak and for all children everywhere." This is a Holocaust story, and it's a very timely story. It's The Good Doctor of Warsaw by Elizabeth Gifford, published by Corvus, and it is available in the shops at the moment. That took quite a bit of time, so the next thing I'm going to do is we've got three giveaways. Straight after the ad break, we're going to give away three books.
People of the Book on 101.9 High FM.
This is People of the Book on 101.9 High FM, Stephen Kravitz, and we've got three giveaways. So get your cell phones ready. The SMS and the WhatsApp numbers I'll give out as soon as I've told you about the books. All you have to do is send us your name and your name and the title of book that you're currently reading. The first one is literary fiction. It's a short book. It's called Consent. It's by Leo Benedictus, published by Faber and Faber. And all we're told is that this book is an experiment. We're experimenting together. You are part of the experiment, if you'll agree to it. Normally, I don't let my subjects choose to be subjects. If you know you're being watched, you cease to be you. But I want you to read this. I wrote it for you. Do you consent? Sometimes you don't want to know what's next. This is the psychological thriller Consent, quite experimental. Leo Benedictus is a freelance feature writer for The Guardian newspaper and other publications. His first novel, The After Party, was published in 2011, and it was very well received by the critics. So that's the first book, Leo Benedictus, Consent. It's a psychological thriller. The second book is a bit of a satire on contemporary life. It's by Joe Dunthorne, and it's called The Adulterants. I am on my way to meet Mari and Lee at a pub called O'Malley's. We are friends again because it's hard to make meaningful new relationships when you're over 30. Ray is not a bad guy. He mostly did not cheat on his heavily pregnant wife. He only sometimes despises every one of his friends. And though his career as a freelance tech journalist is dismal, his afternoon spent churning out third-rate listicles in his boxer briefs, he dreams of making a difference. But Ray is about to discover that his special talent is for making things worse. Brace yourself for a wickedly funny look at the modern everyday man. He's crippled by ironic misanthropy and semi-ironic underachievement. He's stubbornly ensconced in an adolescence that has extended well beyond his biological prime. With lacerating wit and wry affection, Joe Dunthorne dissects the urban millennial psyche of a man too old to be an actual millennial. The Adulterants is an uproarious tale of competitively sensitive men and catastrophic open marriages, riots on the streets of London, and internet righteousness, and one man's valiant quest to come of age in his 30s. So the third book is The Song for Sarah, Lessons from My Mother. It's written by Jonathan Janssen. We interviewed him a few weeks ago on the radio here for another book that came out recently for him, which was a snapshot of the situation of South African universities. This book, Song for Sarah, pays tribute to Jonathan Janssen's mother and to all mothers who raise families and build communities in trying circumstances. Janssen offers this endearing praise song to contradict vulgar stereotypes of Cape Flat mothers. So these are the three books that we are giving away. All you need to do is send us an SMS on 34519 or a WhatsApp on 0618951019. Give us your name and the title of the book that you're currently reading, and if you are one of our three winners, you'll get a copy of this book from Chai FM, People of the Book on 101.9 Chai FM. Now it's 25 past 11, so I've got time for one more review before we interview our guest for today, Nachama Brody. And the book that I'm going to talk about is one of those magical books. The first thing that I thought of when I saw the book, it's called The Toy Makers, was this is going to be similar to The Night Circus, which was a magical book that came out a few years ago by Erin Morgenstern, who incidentally has a new book coming out in the second half of this year. And The Toy Makers lived up to that comparison. It's set in London, starts in 1907, and it's centered around a toy shop, the Emporium, Papa Jack's Toy Emporium. And it is one of those books that are just totally, totally magical. This toy shop only opens for a few months every year at the first snowfall at the beginning of autumn going into winter in London. The toy shop opens and it closes when the first snowflake flower, the snowbell flower, opens at the beginning of spring. So there's a variation in the times that the shop is open every year. And the shop is owned by Papa Jack, a big, tall, giant of a man who somehow uses expertise beyond the rational to create magical toys. And at the beginning of the book, his two sons are old enough to compete with their father to make the type of toys that are so magical they will define children's youth. The two sons are Casper and Emil. And joining this shop at the very beginning is a young woman who is pregnant and she's not married. She's 16 years old and she's running away from her family to London, Kathy Ray, and she ends up being employed by this toy emporium. And the story then follows them, Papa Jack, Emil, Casper, and Kathy, over many years through the passage of World War I and into 1920s London. When Kathy gets a job at the toy emporium, she actually never leaves. But there's also a love triangle between the two brothers and her. And then there's the backstory. Where did these toy makers come from? And the type of toys that they make. These paper trees that you throw this round egg on the ground and out from this egg grows this paper tree. There are flying birds. There are mechanical dogs that almost have a life and a relationship, a proper relationship with their parents. And there's intense competition between the two brothers to keep coming up with the most wonderful, wonderful toys. And there's competition between the two brothers for the affections of Kathy. There is this heartbreaking story of how this family of two sons and this giant of a man, a father, left Eastern Europe to come to London to start this toy emporium. It's pure magic. Just the whole idea of this shop with space that just expands within these narrow walls within London, this magical realism makes The Toy Makers far more than just a fantasy read. And it's set in London with World War I and then all the developments of jazz age London happening in the background. It's a beautiful story, intense emotions, and this unbelievable sense of magical magical reality, which imbibes every single page of the book. And the cover has this beautiful picture of a toy soldier standing within the windows of a toy shop. You just can't miss the magical nature of the book. And if you had a wonderful childhood and there were toys that, you know, Toy Story, the whole movie franchise shows us the relationships that children have with toys. If you hanker back for that sense of being a child, The Toy Makers by Robert Dinsdale, published by Del Rey, recreates that whole sense of childhood and that relationship with toys within this magical, magical toy shop. So that's The Toy Makers by Robert Dinsdale. We've looked at that book, and we've also looked at The Good Doctor of Warsaw by Elizabeth Gifford. If you want to win one of the three books that we spoke about, Song for Sarah by Jonathan Janssen, The Adulterants by Joe Dunthorne, and Consent by Leo Benedictus, just SMS us on 34519 with your name and the title of the book that you are reading, or WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019 and tell us your name and the title of book that you're reading. Because right now we are going into an interview with our guest for today. Our guest is Nechama Brody, N.R. Brody.
Hello.
The book is Knucklebone. It's published by Macmillan. And welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's very exciting to have you in the studio. I was very excited to read the book. But instead of me introducing you to our authors, every single person who's interviewed by me gets the same first question. Please introduce yourself in your own words and on your own terms.
Okay. I suppose I have different terms. My name is Nechama Brody, and I've been a journalist for the last 20-something years. I've published, I actually can't remember, it's 5 or 6 nonfiction books over the last 10 years. This is my first novel, and it's out under N.R. Brody. There are reasons for that. We can talk about it if anyone's interested. And Knucklebone is a detective story and a thriller, and maybe it's a supernatural thriller. There's a little bit of what some people might call the supernatural or the occult. In fact, the first fiction that I ever published a couple of years ago was a short story about a golem in Johannesburg. This doesn't have any golems in it, but it has a lot of African traditional beliefs brought in. And it starts off as sort of a classic detective story, which is really, I suppose, the kind of thing that we all worry about in Johannesburg, is a gunshot in the middle of the night and a dead body at the end of that. But it evolves into something else as this ex-cop and a woman who's still working in the police force try and work together to figure out why the different pieces of the events of that night don't quite match. They uncover stories along sort of animal poaching and animal trafficking. And in order to follow that up, they have to work with a whole bunch of people that they wouldn't normally do, which are, in the Joburg context, sangomas. There are some witches. There's some interesting mixes in there. So I've introduced the book more than me, but you can ask more later if you need.
I was going to ask you the basic story of Knucklebone. I've read it, but yeah. you wrote it, so you can do more justice.
I mean, it started off really wanting to try and find some explanation for things that are often inexplicable. I finished writing the story originally 5 years ago. I went through several rewrites after the first draft. But at the time, there was a lot of press around rhino poaching in particular. And since then, unfortunately, it's expanded to our greater awareness of lion bone poaching, pangolin poaching. But I work a lot anyway with crime information and crime data. I work part-time as I head up the training and research division for Africa Check, which is an independent fact-checking organization. I'm doing my own thesis relating to media reports of crime. But sometimes you come across stories and it doesn't seem to make sense. And people, you sort of think people can't be that bad or that stupid or that weird or that crazy. And I suppose over time you realize that they are all of those things. But it was for me trying to sort of imagine what else could possibly be behind this increase in poaching at the moment. And the story that came to me was not dissimilar to, I suppose, how the rest of the world approached Africa when they wanted our gold and our diamonds and our cheap labor, was that Africa, you know, if you look at Europe, I mean, they used to have lions and, you know, wild animals of their own, and they've wiped most of them out. Asia is in the process of wiping out many of its large wild animals. But Africa still has not a lot, but some left. And depending on which systems of belief you subscribe to, animals have a particular potency and a particular power. People have used animals as totems for centuries. In every culture, almost, an animal has symbolized, you know, the Lion of Judah. I mean, whatever. You know, we know that animals symbolize strength and power. And so it was this imagined version of the reality that we find ourselves in, which was, what if people are taking our animals not just because they can make huge amounts of money off it? What if it's a literal, almost a magical battle? But then it comes back to, I don't want to put people off who aren't really interested in magic, because it is at its heart a detective story.
But the magic in the book actually does explain to South Africans who don't engage with Sangomas, it does contextualize that magic.
What I've tried to do in the book is, I think in a lot of stories, and I'm going to say the kinds of stories I grew up reading growing up in Johannesburg, stories in magazines, but also the types of how we were taught history. Growing up as a white South African during apartheid, and even today, we are taught that Sangomas are sort of these weird bad people who do all these horrible things. In my book, the Sangomas are the good people. They're working with the cops, and they're saying, hold on a second, we've got all these foreigners coming in, and not just foreigners from Asia, but foreigners from Europe coming in and trying to steal our stuff. And they're not doing it for a good reason. Something bad is going on here. And that, in a sense, is not far from the reality. So it involved working closely with a group of different women who are Sangomas, incredible, wonderful, contemporary women. These are not the stereotypes that we are taught. And so part of a book like this, I hope, is an unlearning of the misinformation that many of us were fed growing up. If you can imagine the stereotype of a Jew with his, you know, hooked nose and his whatever, we're taught exactly the same things about other cultures, and we've absorbed them so easily, and we never question them. So this book is, it's not directly questioning them, but it's assuming that, you know, it takes into its stride that actually that's not the reality. So it challenges a lot of stereotypes about the roles that people like that play and how we interact with each other in Johannesburg, which is a very big melting pot.
The knowledge that you have of the police and how crime is investigated comes across on the page as a very, very strong skill that you have. How did you research? You do work for a fact-checking organization, but how did you get into the police procedural?
That was mostly sort of borrowed from legal documents and reading and reports, and not actually spending physical time with the police. I tried, but it's hard to find people who are willing to let you in. And also, this wasn't intended as a book that was going to be a criticism of police procedure. So, in fact, several people have said to me it makes the police look a little bit more positive, or at least in the sense that people read this and understand how difficult it is for police to deal with what they're doing. And so from that perspective, working as a journalist and in research I've done around crime data and statistics, where we look at what I'm interested in is the way we think crime happens versus the way crime actually happens. So many of us have a lot of misconceptions around who is guilty, who is suspicious, who's responsible for crime. And the reality is often quite different to that. So I think that for me, the police have so many different roles within that. First of all, they have this massive administrative role. And anybody who's ever worked even as a teacher will know that the fun part is a really minute part of your day, or the saving lives is a small part of your day. And the rest is admin and paperwork, and it's boring and it's painful and it's difficult. On top of which, you've got a mix of a whole bunch of different cultures. And at the heart of it, I think we need to remember that I really strongly believe the majority of people who work in the police force in this country have the biggest hearts and are brave and are doing it for absolutely the right reasons. You don't volunteer to become a police officer because it's an easy way to make a living, unless you're Richard and Bluey, but we're not going to get into that. You know, so most people who do it literally put their lives on the line, and this acknowledges it in a brief way. But actually, it doesn't hopefully get bogged down in police procedure, because a lot of what happens has to happen outside of the police station. Because, well, you couldn't. How would you fill in a report that said this happened when I'm not really sure what actually happened there? So it includes all of those things.
We're in conversation with Nechama Brody about her new book, Knucklebone. It's a crime thriller set in Johannesburg. We've got more questions for Nechama straight after this ad break.
People of the Book on 101.9 High FM.
Pick and Pay Harper Norwood has the following special valid today between 4 and 8. Chocolate Tree Choco Nuts, 450 grams, was R179.99, now R137.99. The Choc Tree Pesach Cocoa Powder, 300 grams, was R67.99, now R44.99. Ta'am Vareach Ground Cumin, 100 grams, was R29.99, now R25.99. Ta'am Vareach Chicken Barbecue Seasoning, 120 grams, was R34.99, now R29.99. Ta'am Vareach Grilled Fish Seasoning, 100 grams, was R34.99, now R29.99. Only today between 4 and 8 p.m. That's Pick and Pay Harper Norwood. This is People in the Book on 101.9 High FM. And we've got Nechama Brody in. She's talking about her book, Knucklebone. It's a novel, a crime thriller. It's published by Macmillan. It is available in the shops at the moment. And it's an otherworldly book together with a police crime thriller. The otherworldly element is the magic element that you've already mentioned, and you've touched on the answer to the question I'm going to ask you. How did you research this part of the book?
So I think I've always been the kind of person that has believed in the potential for things that are not ordinary, or that maybe we would call supernatural. And I'm not saying I can prove that they exist. I've never seen a ghost. I grew up believing in vampires, but I think I just had a very overactive imagination. I also think that there's a natural progression if you have any sort of religious faith at all, whether or not you're Jewish. But every religious tradition has a mystical tradition somewhere. It's not always acknowledged or liked, but there often is one. And from that, we need to acknowledge that other traditions have similar beliefs, similar mysticisms, and similar concepts around magic. So magic is not something that's foreign in the first place as a concept. And if you believe that, if you believe in one sort of magic, why, in a sense, you should really believe in all sorts. And so, of course, I needed new words and new things to describe and understand different types of magical traditions. Don't really know much about Jewish mystical tradition, personally. I don't have any in-depth knowledge. But it would be easier for me, once you're inside the community, it's like the words make sense to you. So now you have to come as an outsider. And if you're lucky, find people who are insiders, but who are willing to talk to you. And for me, that started off on Twitter, where several years ago, it was a really great place to meet new types of people in Johannesburg. And one of the women that I met was a Sangoma. She's actually giving a talk at the end of this month at the Johannesburg Theater. I think it's on the 24th or the 25th of March. And I went to meet with her. She was still living in Maboneng at that time. I mean, and this is where people need to understand the Sangoma is not necessarily some old guy who's in some funny, dark place. They can be hipsters. They're just normal people, but with wisdom and with access to a different way of thinking, and access to different levels of thinking. So I went to meet with Nokulinda Mkize, who's on Twitter as Nok Sangoma. I met with her a couple of times, and then between me finishing the first draft of the book and reaching a final draft, Nokulinda had three children. This is how long it sometimes takes to make a book happen. And so she referred me to other Sangomas, other women that she'd worked with, that she'd initiated, that I then consulted again. So I would go and visit. I would have the bones thrown for me. Maybe they would do a reading for me. We would discuss some of the processes. I would ask questions. And generally, I was very fortunate that they were open in answering most of my questions, but there were also questions that they wouldn't answer. And again, that's fair. The same thing would happen within our own religious structure. There would be questions where someone would say, no, you are not initiated, or you're not old enough to know. And I was told similar things. So there were some questions I didn't get an answer to. And then with the final draft of the book, I worked via email with another Sangoma who's based in Bloemfontein, Gogo Malapensa, and really just, again, young, contemporary, educated woman, so insightful, so concise in their notes to me, and not afraid at calling me out. I didn't realize, I think, at the time how prominent the Sangomas would be as a character in the book. They're not the narrators, but they are a very strong part of the book. And obviously, this is a difficult time to write somebody else's culture that's not your own. And it's important as writers, particularly as white writers, that we do strong diligence and go beyond what is the basic requirement if you are going to include other cultures and other people's voices in your books.
You've raised two things during the course of the interview that I want to just ask you a bit more about. The one is this idea of cultural appropriation. Lionel Shriver spoke in Australia not so long ago about the need for understanding to allow a person from a totally different background to write about your culture. And that if we say, no, you're not a black person, you can't write about black culture, or you're not a Chinese person, you can't write about Chinese culture, we're actually putting barriers between people and sharing experiences. And you've said that as long as you've done that, you've made the effort to cross the divide with a lot of research so that it's factual and it's as true as it can be. Are you comfortable with it? I actually think as a writer, we should try venture beyond ourselves.
Okay, so there's a yes and no part of that. I think that there are many writers who write as other cultures, who write as other voices, and who are not called out for it because they do it well. They have done the work. Not only have they done the research, not only have they put in the time, but they have invited many other people to read and appraise and critique their work. They have taken that criticism on board. What is lazy thinking is a white man in America or a white man in Britain or whatever thinking that he can write as a black woman or a woman at all and thinking, oh, well, he can just get away with kind of phoning it in, which is what white male writers and white writers have done for centuries. I mean, predominantly men because women were not published as much up until, you know, the last couple of decades. And that is laziness. And that is where cultural appropriation becomes a real problem. It is not that you can never write anything else outside yourself. Otherwise, I would only be writing novels about sort of white Jewish women in Johannesburg. And really, there's a very limited market for that. But if you are going to let somebody else's voice become part of your novel, or is it a stand-in for something? Are you introducing them as a metaphor for something else? And I think the problem, and even Lionel Shriver, I have a problem with his speech there. I don't think that she had that butterfly on her head. Sorry, I'm having a moment here. When she did that whole thing, it was like, oh, we need to do this. It's not our right. And at the same time, as white writers, there's a difference between diversity and appropriation. And I don't think that Lionel Shriver understood that. And I don't think that many of the authors who say, but how can you say I can't write these other things, is do the legwork and no one will accuse you of appropriation because you'll actually have a better understanding when you try and include those voices there. So the other problem is that as white writers, we often tend to drown out new authors, black authors, or, you know, in America they talk about people of color, so we have diverse different authors coming through. What are you doing in your quest for, you know, are you bringing a character in just because a black man is a stand-in for a suspicious person or a threat in your book? You know, like in horror films, there's always that whole thing that the black character dies first, right? It's a standard trope within horror films. Like, you know, the black character is going to be the first to die. So if you've introduced a black character in your book just to be the first person to die, or if you've introduced a black character in your book just to be a stand-in for someone who's poorly educated or somebody who has an absent parent or somebody who's violent, that's lazy and that's appropriation. You've now brought something in under the guise of supposedly wanting to be diverse, but all you've done is a decorative version of it. So have I done it well enough? I don't know. That is a constant challenge for me. I've had some very positive responses and feedback to this book. But there's always a possibility that I've crossed a line somewhere, and then it becomes my responsibility to own it and to do better, to write better next time, to, you know, all of those things are really, really important. to sit and say when it's so easy for white writers relative to other writers, how hard it is for us if we're cut off from writing, you know, characters that we want to bring into our book. It's a cheek. It really is. I think it's laziness and it's entitlement that makes speeches like that. And also, if we really want to cross over and learn about other cultures and other people, what's the best way you're going to learn about a Sangoma or somebody who is Indian or somebody who is Chinese? Is it going to be through me? No, of course not. You know, you need to have real black friends, not just some of my best friends are. You need to spend time reading authors from other cultures. So, again, our role is to say, oh, hold on, if you're interested in this, you should read more. But don't make me the Wikipedia of diversity, and that's enough.
Yeah, a great answer. It's a lot of food for thought. We'll be back with a few more questions for Nechama Brody, author of Knuckle Bone, straight after this break.
People of the Book on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is People in the Book on 101.9 Chai FM. We've got Nechama Brody, local author in the studio. She's the author of 5 books already, nonfiction. Her first novel, her first crime thriller novel, is Knuckle Bone. It's published by Macmillan. And we're in conversation with Nechama. You also mentioned that you had a fact checking. Was it an NGO or organization or group?
I run the training part for the organization. I do work with them. They're called Africa Check. They're online at africacheck.org. I've worked with them for about the last 5 years. And so Africa Check is an independent, nonpartisan fact-checking organization based in Johannesburg, but it has offices also in Kenya and in Nigeria and in Senegal. And about 3 years ago, I just have to remember in my head because now I'm getting old and all the years are stacking up. About 3 years ago, we launched a separate training and research division, and I run the training, and we do commercial research if people need that, not just in South Africa, but in other countries. So I get to travel around sometimes, and I've been training journalists and researchers in Zimbabwe and in Kenya and coming from other countries in Africa, either to Johannesburg or to Nairobi for training. And that teaches you a lot too. You know, nothing shows you how badly I sometimes like to think I'm quite smart. And then I learn a whole bunch of new stuff that exposes so many flaws in my knowledge, which is embarrassing at the time, but ultimately is quite pleasant in the long term.
We don't have much time left, but I wanted to ask you a very topical question. Mm. We're living in the age of fake news.
Yes.
We've got a president of America who runs increasingly now foreign policy on Twitter.
Yeah.
The need to check facts, the need to research a character you're going to put in your book, that must be, this need for authenticity. That has to be something that's very close to your heart, because otherwise you wouldn't be a journalist and fact-checking. Your thoughts on what's going around the world at this moment in time?
Fiction is fiction. Mm. Most of this book is made up. Even parts where I could research things, I've manipulated things to suit my story. So fiction is separate to that, but it often works better if it has a basis in reality. In terms of what I like to call false news rather than fake news has been so badly used, and it's been weaponized by politicians who are then using it to clamp down on media freedom, which is quite problematic, or using it so often that it becomes what's a very traditional propaganda technique called disinformatia, which is to dilute and disperse the definition of it so widely that it becomes meaningless, that there is no more truth. Within that, the internet, which is the greatest problem, is also the greatest solution. Are we able to use it effectively as a tool to check the information that we share with each other, to check the sources that we use? We can if we're able to step outside of ourselves. And what fact-checking teaches you is it teaches you a methodology, and part of that methodology allows you to hopefully push your own bias out of the way a little bit and start realizing how much bias you have, the shortcomings in your own knowledge. When people self-assess, they often tend to think that they're much better than they really are at driving, at research, at all of those things. We're the same with knowledge. Even those of us who went to a good school and maybe have a university degree, we don't actually know as much as we think we do. in the last 5 years since I've been working with Africa Check, it's transformed my journalism and transformed my thought processes as an individual. I'm on social media quite a lot. It's important that we learn how to pause and take 10 seconds between being outraged and wanting to respond and share and swear at somebody and to check. Well, is that information accurate? Is it current? Is it relevant? We can check text. We can check photographs. I'm going to be starting training for high school students this year across Johannesburg as part of a program with an Argentinian fact-checking organization. So we were really trying to share a new way of thinking about all this information that's coming streaming at us. And the more people do that, the better. But the first thing we need to check is ourselves.
So we're out of time. I've got more questions to ask you, but thank you for coming to the studio. The book was a great read. I read it in a few short days, and I really got caught up with the characters, Ian, Jack, and Reshma, and the Sangomas, and the witches, and the Chinese. I love the fact that you were mentioning Cyril Dean twice in the book, and our work there. And you can picture Jeppy's Town in the book because you've been there.
Yeah.
It's a great book. I'll say Mazel Tov, and I hope it does very well. And next time you've got another book that you're launching, we'll bring you in, and we'll continue the conversation.
Thank you.
Until next week, good Shabbos, and keep reading.